This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As we approach the new year, we take time to look back and reflect on those we lost in 2011. During the year, we took note of 8 North Carolinians who contributed a great deal to the cultural and political life of the state and the nation. We begin today's retrospective with Reynolds Price, who passed away in January at the age of 77. It may not have been obvious from the start of his life that Reynolds Price would become one of the best writers of the 20th century. He was born at the depth of the Great Depression, at the poorest edge of eastern North Carolina. But once he began writing, his genius was clear. The New York Times called his first novel A Moment of Truth That Is Art. Reynolds Price won a Faulkner Award for that book, A Long and Happy Life, and he won many admirers who quickly compared him to the writer for whom the prize was named. His impact on the world of letters and the many students he taught as a professor of literature at Duke for more than 50 years cannot be measured. I spoke with writer Alan Gerganis, who was a friend, colleague, and admirer of Reynolds Price. I began by asking him how Price handled the praise early in his career when he was hailed as the next Faulkner.
He resented being compared to Faulkner. I think all of us who grew up in the South do, because it's a losing proposition. It's like being born in Stratford-on-Avon and having Shakespeare thrown at you constantly. But his originality was in the simplicity of his diction, in his lyrical gift, and in his preternatural wisdom. I mean, one of the odd things about novel writing is that there are really no prodigies in writing novels. But Reynolds seemed to have been born with this understanding of community, of compromise, of how religion helps people get through, of blood obligations. It's all there from the very beginning.
His religion and that sense of having it all from the very beginning, I think, was evident in his penultimate book, Letter to a Godchild. And he was on this program talking about that, and he read from it. And I think it tells about in this particular passage that he'll read, it's a moment back when he was 6 or 7 years old and had a vision.
In brief, in a single full moment, I was allowed to see how intricately the vast contraption of nature all around me, and nature included me, my parents, a few yards away in the house, all the animal life in the dense surroundings, and every other creature alive on earth, was bound into a single vast ongoing wheel by one immense power that had willed us into being and intended our futures, wherever they might lead, through the pattern, the enormously intricately woven pattern, somehow bound at the rim and cohering for as long as the Creator willed it.
The late Reynolds Price, reading from his book Letter to a Godchild, which was published in 2006, a vision that he had at 6 or 7 that he probably spent a lifetime trying to describe.
It's true. Well, he had the wisdom, I think, to go to the Gospels and translate the Gospels and see the Gospels as his great source and bypass the church. He's one of those people who believed in Christ and not in Christianity, except as he practiced it. And he had a vision when he was marked for cancer of Christ as a kind of redeemer with a kind of promise, a promise that was kept. I mean, Reynolds had 25 years after this hideous diagnosis. And I once talked at a party to a surgeon who had told me, after having a few drinks, that the chances of Reynolds surviving that first cancer were infinitesimal, that it was only his force of will, his depth of personality, his faith, as it were, that kept him writing. And so there's something very powerful about seeing him complete his project.
A sense of completion that is reflected in his life as well as the work. A man who enjoyed great success early on, that often destroys a man or certainly affects their writing, and somehow he kept going.
He also found a great home at Duke University. I mean, I grew up in Rocky Mount, which is 30 miles from Macon, where Reynolds was born, and that was one of our bonds, was remembering being bullied as kids. I mean, people don't realize that if you're an artist and if you're gay, you're a target. There's this kind of mythologizing that everybody knew he was a genius from the beginning. He was adored by his family. He was an only child for his first 10 years and an only child for many generations. So that, of course, he was a prodigy from the very beginning. He was beautiful and insanely articulate and utterly charming and was to the last minute of his life. But I think at Duke, he found himself taken seriously. And he was an extremely loyal person to those who were loyal to him.
You were not, strictly speaking, a student of his, but he taught for a long time. And teaching seemed to be very, very important to him. He wanted to be in the classroom.
Even at his final illness, he was determined to go back and teach the Milton course. And his student and mentee, Will Weldon, has made a complete film about the impact of Reynolds' teaching, which is very beautiful and very forceful. I think, you know, had he only been a teacher, he would have made a huge contribution. But it's that combination of being a public citizen and a private artist and a real friend that sets him apart and makes us miss him. And just hearing his magisterial voice here in the studio makes me miss him all the more and makes me see that the size and the scale of his mission was what moved me most. It was not a perfect person. None of us is. But to remain true and faithful to the scope of his talent and ambition, I think, makes him a continuing inspiration to us all.
Writer Alan Gerganis remembering Reynolds Price. Another North Carolina legend left us. Billy Taylor died at the very end of last year. He was 89. He was born in Greenville, but moved to Washington, D.C. at an early age. The celebrated pianist received most of his music training there before making it big in New York City in the 1940s. But more than a musician, Billy Taylor is remembered as a proud patron of the arts, an educator, a radio and TV personality, and a mentor to many. I spoke with Carol DeShiel, the jazz coordinator at East Carolina University School of Music. Carol also serves as artistic director of the annual Billy Taylor Jazz Festival at ECU. I also spoke with Ira Wiggins, who's the director of jazz studies at North Carolina Central University. But let's begin this appreciation with the voice of Billy Taylor himself, who I spoke with on our program 2 years ago. I asked him how he started playing the piano.
I took some piano lessons, and I wanted to play like my Uncle Bob, and that didn't come from playing piano. He played by ear, and I played some wonderful ragtime piano. So I wanted to play like Uncle Bob. And my dad said, no, you'll go and study some music and you learn to play properly and so forth. And that was boring.
Well, now there's a story, and I want to know if it's true that your piano teacher thought you were pretty good but really encouraged your parents to spend more time on your brother. He was going to be the prodigy, right?
That's absolutely right. My brother, incidentally, is younger, and he is in real estate.
Billy Taylor, we talked with him, the late Dr. Billy Taylor, talked with him about 2 years ago. Carol DeShiel, you had a chance to play with Billy Taylor. What was he like on stage?
Just incredible. The first time that I had the opportunity to play with him, he was the guest artist at a performance at Howard University, and we were in rehearsal, and then we didn't have time to rehearse because of his flight getting in late, and he walked on stage, and he said, I think I like Body and Soul in B-flat, and boom, that was it. We just started, and it was an honor, and I was blown away playing with him, shaking in my boots.
Well, Ira Wiggins, you talked, too, about his work as an ambassador for jazz and
right.
as a jazz educator.
Right. And at an MENC conference in 1964, he played a vital role in convincing a lot of the music educators that weren't necessarily jazz musicians that this music should play an essential role in American education in terms of music education. And one of the things that he said was that jazz plays a vital role in terms of its dexterity and the technical knowledge that's necessary for the performance of this music at the highest order. And it should be utilized for the more comprehensive training of today's young musicians. So that was in 1964 when he says that, and it's still true today.
Yeah, and he was on the radio and on the TV and
exactly.
in classrooms and every place he could find.
Right.
To talk with people about that. Carol, Dr. Taylor just passed away last week, and I know that you have a festival now named in his honor. Anything special for this year's festival?
Well, this year we're actually, of course, being named in his honor, we always do something, in tribute to him, and we usually close the festival each year with his composition, I Wish I Knew how it would feel to be free.
Well, it's fitting that you close with what has to be his most famous work, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free,
yeah.
An anthem of the civil rights movement and a brilliant song famously covered by Nina Simone. And we had a chance to talk with Dr. Taylor about how he came to write that song.
I actually wrote it for my daughter. I was trying to explain to her that about our history and as a race and some of the things that we did musically. And, you know, she was a kid. She's playing with dollars, and she didn't want to hear that lecture at that particular time, you know. But, I was a father, so she had to listen for a minute. So in demonstrating what I was trying to say to her, because she had been singing a spiritual, and I was saying, no, you got to feel it different than that, you know. That's part of what we should know about. And so after I lectured her, she went back and played with her daughter, thanks Dad, and went on. But I said to myself, I said, gee, that wasn't a bad little thing that I was playing for her. And I fooled around with it for a minute. And so in, I would say, about 15 minutes, I wrote the first verse, and it's only 16 bars, and I wrote the first verse, and it took me a year and a co-writer to finish it, what I really wanted to say once I started it, and I felt Nina Simone really captured what I had in mind when I was trying to explain to my daughter about where it came from.
Billy Taylor died in December of 2010 at the age of 89. Coming up, we pay tribute to a North Carolina photojournalist who died in the line of duty. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Continuing with our appreciations of those we lost in 2011. Photojournalist Chris Hondros had been on our show a couple of times talking about his work in some of the most dangerous places on Earth. We were shocked and saddened when we learned he was killed in Libya last April. He was doing what Chris did, working in a place where we wouldn't go to send us images that we need to see. Chris grew up in Fayetteville and graduated from North Carolina State University. He eventually went on to work at the Fayetteville Observer. After that, it was off to New York City. He became an award-winning journalist and was a finalist for the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Breaking News Photography. But those kind of accolades weren't as important to him as telling a story. In one of his most famous photographs, taken in 2003, a young Liberian militia commander jumps for joy after firing a rocket launcher. That photograph went around the world, and Chris could have left it at that. But 2 years later, he returned to Liberia, and he tracked down that young man to a shanty in Monrovia. He was no longer a soldier, and he seemed aimless, so Chris helped him enroll in school. Friends say that's just the kind of guy Chris was. He was concerned not just with the photos, but the people behind them. I spoke with a couple of those friends back in April when Chris was killed. J.D. Pooley knew Chris since the 1990s when they worked together at the Troy Daily News in Ohio. And our own producer, Amber Nimix, was a longtime friend of Chris and worked with him at the Fayetteville Observer. I asked Amber to characterize the kind of work Chris did.
I think that Chris was always taking pictures of people, no matter where he was, whether he was doing a local story about, you know, shopping at the Kmart, or if he was dodging bullets in a danger zone. He was looking for how people were being affected by the news. And because he felt very urgently, I think that it was his role and his responsibility to bring the stories of other humans to back to those people, those of us who are safe at home.
J.D., you are a photojournalist yourself. What does it take to snap those kind of pictures under the circumstances that Chris found himself in much of the time?
Yeah, Frank, that's just one of the things that made, you know, Hondros so special. When he was in conflict zones, he could concentrate, think about every move that he was making. I can remember talking to him when he first started covering battles, excuse me, in Afghanistan. He was James Nachwe, one of the most famous photographers that have been doing this for 30 years. He used to watch him, and we would talk about him, the moves that he would make, and Chris would point out how calm he was, and always watching his back and making sure every step that he took in every situation was the right move.
We talked with Chris back in 2009 on this program and asked him what it takes to be a good war photographer, and here's what he said.
I would say that some people's personality types can deal with chaos, can deal with uncertainty. They don't need to have things the same way every day. They can, and I think I'm that way, whether it's shaped me or I was like that in the first place, I'm not sure. And I think that's really the critical issue. The real adrenaline type junkies I've noticed, who are often attracted to photography and to war photography, do not last very long, actually. They go on a few trips, but if you're doing it for that reason, it's not going to fulfill you for long.
That's Chris Hondros, who spoke with us on the state of things in 2009. Amber Nimmix, he did war photography. That's what we know him for. But you know him at a time long before he was off in battle zones. And you say he took as much time and paid as much attention to stuff that most photographers and even reporters didn't want to touch.
Yeah, Chris never did anything halfway, not in his life and not in his personal life or professional life. I worked with him. There was a really great group of us at the Fayetteville Observer in the mid to late 90s. And I was the editor of the Saturday Extra community news special. So you can imagine I handed out some really less than prize assignments of, a Boy Scout Eagle Award ceremonies and Pet of the Week and that kind of thing. And Chris, we all knew that Chris was destined to go on to much greater things, but he never stuck up his nose at that sort of thing. He would take a picture for all it was worth. My husband, who also worked with him there, we all worked together at that time. They got the assignment, the inevitable December 26th assignment to go and cover people bringing toys back to Kmart, which is just about the laziest thing that any editor ever thought of. And Chris, rather than just going in there and snapping some shots and leave, he was climbing the shelves to get the very best shot of people bringing toys back to Kmart that he could possibly get, and the security at Kmart was like, get down off, we're going to get sued, it didn't matter. He found the shot no matter what. He worked it.
And J.D., apparently it wasn't just about the shot. You talked about a story that you remember from your days at the Troy Daily News in Ohio of Chris doing a photo shoot, a story on a man who is homeless in Miami County. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was when Chris was going to grad school at OU. We heard about a homeless man living in a really sketchy shelter. We did a little research on the gentleman. It turns out he had some mental issues. No one really knew too much about him. They said he might be armed, but that didn't deter Chris. He went right in. He wanted to meet this man. He wanted to tell a story. It took a while for the man to open up. And Chris had that time. He spent close to a week with this gentleman, driving him into town, taking him out to eat, actually friending this man. Because, that's the right thing to do. Chris wouldn't show up just to shoot a photo of him and say, thank you very much. I got what I needed. He wanted to know this person.
J.D. Pooley worked with Chris Hondros at the Troy Daily News in Ohio, and our own producer, Amber Nimmix, was a longtime friend of Chris Hondros and worked with him at the Fayetteville Observer. Now we remember artist Roy Gusso, who died last February at the age of 92. He created the gleaming glass and steel sculpture known simply as the Egg to students at NC State. This remarkable structure was unveiled in 1961. Gusso had a hand in creating many other more famous sculptures, including José de Rivera's Infinity, that stands in front of the Smithsonian Institute's American History Museum in Washington, D.C. But the mark he made on NC State as an early member of what was then the School of Design is truly indelible. Gusso came to NC State at the invitation of Henry Camp Hefner, the first dean of what was then called North Carolina State College School of Design. Marvin Malika is the current dean of the College of Design at NC State. I asked him why Camp Heffner was interested in Gusso.
Well, Roy was brought in, I believe, because he really believed that that education was about a rebirth, a time to break down preconceived notions. In fact, I'm actually sitting here quoting from something that he said in a taped interview some years ago. He talked about that before you construct anything, you had to destroy something, that instruction with the idea of reconstruction. If you give people the opportunity to discover things for themselves, it becomes meaningful. It is necessary to create that atmosphere, that opportunity. Students should be constantly challenged to question what they've done and not to take anything for granted, not to assume anything. And then he goes on to say experimentation, discovery, and exploitation are the steps of the development of a design concept. Therefore, they should be the steps of the curriculum. And I think that fits so beautifully into what the Dean Camp Heffner, was trying to do. He wanted this common first 2 years on the Bauhaus model. And so he went out and he sought people like Roy.
Let me interrupt you there and forgive me for that. But what was going on at NC State in 1950? Why there? Why would these ideas come to a place like NC State?
Well, I think the people at NC State at the time saw design in a way that was very similar to the way people in Germany saw the Bauhaus. Bauhaus was located ultimately in Dessau because that's where the factories were. Well, NC State as an institution was, with its land-grant traditions, was always interested in manufacturing and agriculture, advancing the society and the culture through the enhancement of its economy. So the School of Design was brought forward because you were going to prepare architects for this new progressive society. You were going to rethink the use of land for growing communities. And ultimately, the first department that Dean Camp Heffner wanted to add after architecture and landscape architecture was product design. And that was to help with the textile industry, with the manufacturing industry in North Carolina, furniture industry, for example. So that's what was going on. There was this, I think, energy, this progressive belief that North Carolina was going to have to build its talent base, was going to have to build the people and prepare the people to go forward. And we fit that model. I think it's interesting to note that the original proposers for the new school of what they were calling architecture and landscape architecture were the deans of engineering and agriculture. They were proposing the new school.
But if you think about that, engineering, agriculture, textiles, furniture, all very practical, very functional kinds of design we're talking about. When you look at Roy Gusso's work, it was anything but. It was all this gorgeous design, reflective surfaces, impressionistic, but not particularly useful. Where does he fit in?
Well, he fits into the craft. He insisted on the making of things. The precepts of the Bauhaus was that things would have to rise to the level of art by way of becoming skillful and beautifully made, that art wasn't just a free expression of somebody doing things off the cuff. It was a result of a highly disciplined process of acquiring skills and following through from aspirations to results. And so he fits that. And then he also fits in because he was teaching in the first year studios where he demanded that craft. And he demanded excellence, and he demanded an aesthetic sensibility. So the idea is we're sitting in facilities here that were once a factory, but they, in fact, are quite beautiful. There was no disconnect between the beauty of a factory or the beauty of a church or the beauty of a home. Beauty and function came together.
And you knew him a little bit.
I had the opportunity to meet him in his studios. When I came as dean, I tried very hard to read everything I could and to meet all of the important people I could. And so we had a program with my development officer to go to New York and meet with alumni. And I asked my development officer if she couldn't please set up an appointment for me to meet Roy Gusso. So I met with him in his studio. And I have to tell you, it was a memorable day. I was there for just a short meeting and ended up spending the day with him.
What was he like?
He felt like I was meeting with a young artist. His mind was alive. I was warned that he loved to drink martinis, and I stopped at two, but he kept going. I was warned that he had a high capacity for that. He was an individual who knew how to really live, and his energy for his work and his work at the time, some of the maquettes he was showing me were these wonderful combinations of the what you'd expect, the polished chrome on one side, but on the other side, a beautifully finished wood. And then incorporating maybe into it a streak of color moving through, almost like an enameled version of color. And it was just, he was continuing to grow. He was continuing to explore. And his passions, his discussions about his arguments with the founding dean. Henry Camp Hefner always said that the difference between him and other deans is other deans needed to prove they were smarter than all of their faculty. He wanted to prove that he could hire people smarter than him.
How would you describe his influence on the school?
I think his influence on the school is continuing through design thinking. I mean, what we like to believe is one of the major strengths of the college is design inquiry, and design thinking is very much a part of that.
Marvin Melica, Dean of the College of Design at NC State. He was talking about sculptor Roy Gusso, who died last February at the age of 92. While Gusso had a big impact on North Carolina State, he spent most of his life in his native New York. Ralph Campbell, on the other hand, was born and raised in Raleigh, where he had very strong family and community ties. As a young man, Ralph Campbell Jr. sat around his kitchen table and listened as plans evolved to desegregate Raleigh. Campbell's parents and their children formed the nucleus of the Oval Table Gang, a group of politically active Southeast Raleigh residents who pushed for change throughout the community. As an adult, Ralph used the lessons he learned at his parents' kitchen to become a member of the Raleigh City Council and later North Carolina State Auditor. He was the first African-American elected to statewide executive office. Ralph Campbell Jr. died last January. Cash Michaels is editor of the Carolinian, Raleigh's African-American newspaper. He knew Campbell, and he wrote about him throughout his life. I asked him to describe the political rise of Ralph Campbell Jr.
Ralph Campbell, as an elected leader, came along around the time where we had a number of folks who led the way, created that path to history, so to speak. Raleigh Mayor Clarence Lightner, Dan Blue, the first African-American to serve as Speaker of the House per North Carolina. These were men who they learned a style of leadership. They learned that you had to be clean, professional, knowledgeable. You had to know as much, if not more, than your white counterparts in order to indeed bring about the kind of change that community of colors needed. Ralph Campbell was someone that we could all look to with pride because he was someone who honored the legacy of his parents, of his family. As you know, Ralph Sr. was the bold leader of the Raleigh NAACP back during the Civil Rights Movement. His wife, June K. Campbell, a courageous woman of color who held the hand of her young son, William, as they walked into the Murphy School in Raleigh in June of 1960. So Ralph had legacy behind him, and legacy to him was currency, and he spent every bit of it to be of service and to indeed leave a legacy of pride today.
And he was a serious leader and, as you said, very well connected, someone who was carrying on a legacy. But at the same time, he was well known for his sense of humor and his love of fast cars. How did all of this, these aspects of his character, play into his winning constituents that eventually became, made him a successful politician?
Ralph never, as much as Ralph had style, he certainly had that. I mean, the man never had an ugly day in his life, especially when he was elected to office. And as much as he loved cars and whatever else, Ralph never built a barrier between himself and his community. He was always in his community. He was always speaking out on behalf of his community. When he partied in the community. He lived in the community. It was nothing for Ralph to show up at one of the local barber shops and sit down and jawbone with the fellas there on a Saturday morning. And that's why he was beloved and embraced, because he wasn't someone that as soon as he became successful that he said, okay, community, thanks a lot, I'll see you later. To the contrary, he brought the community with him. Anytime the community called, anytime there was a meeting of leadership, Ralph was there.
And eventually he was elected to the Raleigh City Council in 1985. Then in 1992, he was elected to statewide office and he became auditor. And tell us about that, because it seemed from what I've been able to read that he revolutionized that office, brought it into the 20th century and the threshold of the 21st, and really did some good in terms of picking up where the state was losing out on cash.
Well, certainly. Ralph took, because he was indeed a trained auditor and not just a politician who had won an office, but that he was indeed a trained auditor, then and he knew exactly what to do with the state auditor's office to make it more effective and to make it more efficient. And as a result, and I'll admit I don't have these numbers in front of me, but there was no question that during the 12 years that Ralph Campbell led the state auditor's office, he saved the state of North Carolina tens of millions of dollars without question. And he also led that office in a nonpartisan way. Everyone remembers the kind of war he had with Secretary Carmen Hooker Odom, who was heading up the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, and how Ralph did a very stinging audit of how they were wasting Medicare funds. And she shot back at him in public, and he shot back at her. Governor Easley at the time did not like that, but Ralph did the job he felt he needed to do to be true to his calling, to save this state and to watch every penny that was spent. He took that job very seriously, and it may have cost him, among other things, his fourth reelection bid in 2004.
How so? You mean his honesty and his diligence were the things that undid him?
Yeah, well, you see, keep in mind now that even though Ralph was a Democrat through and through, if he saw Democrats not doing their job as heading up state government agencies, watching after the public trust and the public dollar, his job was to report that, not to cover for them. And there were some folks who felt that that he went after Secretary Hooker Odom for other reasons. He said, no, the Medicare situation here is wasteful. The state can do better, and it should do better. He published his findings. He attended a hearing where he delivered them to the state. As I said before, Democrats did not like that. The governor did not like that. Certainly Secretary Hooker Odom did not like that. But he did his job, and that's the thing that we've always known Ralph to be, an honest man who, if he was given a task to serve the public, he did it and let the chips fall where they may.
Cash Michaels is editor of the Carolinian, Raleigh's African-American newspaper. He knew Ralph Campbell Jr., who died in February at the age of 64. Coming up, we say farewell to a couple of sports legends and a centenarian who revolutionized the way banjo pickers pluck. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're remembering some of the people whose passing we marked earlier this year. Harvey Dorfman died at his home in Brevard, North Carolina, in February at the age of 75. Dorfman was a man who got into the heads of some of the biggest names in professional baseball and dramatically improved their games. He was viewed as the father of sports psychology. Dorfman had a long career helping guys like Roy Halladay, Alex Rodriguez, and Greg Maddux. I spoke with Rick Wolf, sports psychologist and host of the radio show The Sports Edge on WFAN in New York.
Harvey was one of these rare people who did not coddle athletes or ballplayers. He basically just sort of got in their face, and as he said, he held a mirror up to them and said, look, you got a problem. You're not hitting well. You're not pitching well. You're not fielding well. What are you going to do about it? He would not sort of say, let's just sit back and hold hands and think positive thoughts. He would say, you have to deal with this. Now, what are you going to do to change things?
Yeah, but isn't that what managers do? They get in your face. They say, what's going on? We're paying you a lot of money. Get out there and throw strikes. And right?
You would think so, but not really. Not in this day and age of multimillionaire athletes. The managers there are just trying to get all the pieces of the puzzle together for the lineup. But the manager is not going to, particularly when a manager makes a lot less money than his number three batter does, he's not going to yell and scream at his top pitcher or his top hitter. They would rely upon Dorfman to come in and say, look, here's the deal. And in many ways, Harvey was sort of a quasi-manager because he did have a chance to get in these guys' face and say, look, you got to make these adjustments.
Now, he starts out as an English teacher, right? How did he get involved in this kind of endeavor?
He was born and raised in the Bronx, obviously a bright man. Very well read, very literate, was an English teacher. He and his wife, Anita, moved their young family to Vermont, where for many years he was a terrific English teacher in a local high school, prep school. But he used to hang around the AA team for the Vermont Expos in the summertime and became friends with a gentleman named Carl Keel, who eventually went on to work for the Oakland Athletics. Carl and Harvey were good friends. Carl hired Harvey to work on the mental side with the Athletics. If you recall, during the late 80s, that's during the time of the Bash Brothers, the Oakland A's were world champions, and every other team began to say, well, what does Oakland have that we don't have? And they began to realize they had Harvey Dorfman.
So who are some of the big names he worked with?
Over the years, and again, I will tell you that Harvey never really liked to discuss who the ball players were, but you know, the ones he has gone on the record about are people like Brad Lidge, Roy Halladay of the Phillies now, Greg Maddux, I mean, Al Leiter. I'm telling you, not just a few, not like 10, I'm talking dozens. Hmm.
What was he like in person?
He was a terrific guy. I mean, he was accessible, polite, cared about people. I remember one time going down to visit Harvey and Anita in their beautiful home in North Carolina, and I was just stunned. In his office downstairs, he had photos personally autographed from all these big league stars, you know, with comments, sentiments like, "Harvey, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't be in the big leagues. Harvey, I owe my career to you." I can't impress enough upon baseball fans how critically important Dorfman was over the last 20, 30 years to baseball players.
So do you think there's ever going to be a place in Cooperstown for baseball psychologists?
I would sure hope so, Frank. I got to tell you, he was, as I say, extraordinarily influential in so many careers. And in the years to come, when you see the wave of ball players I just mentioned, and some of them, of course, will be inducted into the Hall of Fame, when they give their acceptance speeches, don't be surprised when some of these guys start talking about how much they owe in terms of gratitude to one Harvey Dorfman.
Rick Wolf is a sports psychologist and host of the radio show The Sports Edge on WFAN Radio in New York. Let's stick with sports a little longer and remember hockey great Josef Wasicek. You know, until 2002, the Carolina Hurricanes were pretty much not on anybody's mind. But that year, national attention turned to the hockey team in Raleigh, where fans, I mean really, really loud fans, showed up in droves to support the Canes in the Stanley Cup playoffs. In the finals that year, the Hurricanes faced off against league leaders, the Detroit Red Wings. Game 3 was played at the RBC Center. And although the Canes lost that night, Josef Wasicek tied the score in the second period with a very exciting goal. The young Czech brought Canes fans to their feet with that play in 2002, and he would experience even greater joy as a member of the Hurricanes when they won the Stanley Cup in 2006. Last September, he and 26 other members of his team died in a plane crash in Russia. He was 30 years old. I spoke with Chris Vitiello, who published a commentary about Josef Wasicek in the Independent Weekly, and also Luke DeCock, a sports columnist for the News and Observer in Raleigh.
Joe was just one of the guys that everybody, not just me, everybody got along with Joe. I mean, he was just that kind of kid. He always smiling and just sort of happy-go-lucky, kind of walking around the locker room in a good mood. And so, you know, over the course of his career, pretty much everything that he did in the NHL, with the exception of basically a season and a half before he went to Russia, I was writing about it. So I saw him as a rookie. I saw him score some big goals in the 2002 playoffs. I saw him lead the team in scoring the year 2003-04 right before the lockout. And I saw him the year they won the Stanley Cup get his knee torn apart, watched him rehab for 5 months and fight to get back in time for the playoffs and have a huge game. April 4th, 2006, his first game back, he had a huge game. And just sort of knowing what he'd gone through and seeing him sitting on the bench, you knew what it meant to him. And there were a lot of people who knew Joe like that. I mean, he was just the kind of guy that people liked and gravitated toward. But for me, seeing him sort of come in and his career start and transpire, it was pretty tough to hear about what happened on Wednesday.
Chris, your commentary in the Indy, you highlight Game 3 of the 2002 Stanley Cup Finals.
Well, I think it was Game 5 where the Hurricanes and the New Jersey Devils were fighting out in the first round of the playoffs. And the Canes had won the first two games of the playoff series. They had home ice advantage. They were sort of flying high. They went up to New Jersey and lost a couple of games where they looked somewhat outclassed. I think the New Jersey goalie had really risen to the occasion. Martin Brodeur, the winningest goalie in the NHL. So the Canes came back. Maybe fan confidence had wavered a little bit, and they played a very tight, tense game against the Devils in Game 5. It went into overtime, and Wasicek just made a great shot over Brodeur's shoulder to win it in overtime, and it just really launched the Hurricanes that year. They ran to the finals and It was a spectacular goal.
Well, and that series was all the more delicious because of the way they got their butts kicked in the series the year before.
Yeah. Yeah, the Hurricanes were – they just squeaked into the playoffs in, at the end of the 2000-2001 season and matched up against the Devils, the defending champions that year. And the Devils pushed the Canes around for three games. But they, you know, they fought back. They extended the series to a sixth game, succumbed there. But in the final minutes, I guess about 5-6 minutes left, the fans just stood and cheered as loud as they possibly could. Cheered through the breaks for advertisements and everything. You know, the puck was in play, not in play. It was just a long-standing ovation, and I think it really just showed the team that the fans really appreciated the effort of this club.
Things had really turned around. Luke, Joseph said that he really felt that this place was a home to him. Tell us about his relationship to North Carolina.
It really was. I mean, he loved living here. He loved playing here. When they traded Joe after 2006, after the Stanley Cup year, to Nashville for Scott Walker, another player who had become a big part of the Hurricanes and also this community, and he was in Nashville for only maybe 5 or 6 months before the Hurricanes actually made a trade to get him back and bring him back from Nashville in midway through that 2006-2007 season. And I called him that night and got him on the phone. He was very excited about the trade, and he said, I'm really happy. I'm just excited to be coming home. And that was really the way he looked at it, that as long as he was in America and over here and playing away from the Czech Republic, this was sort of his home away from home. And the joy and sort of excitement in his voice that night was palpable. And it didn't work out for the Hurricanes. They missed the playoffs that year. They made some changes in the offseason. And you know, Joe played 1 year for the New York Islanders, ends up in Russia, and the rest is history. But he always enjoyed his time here. You know, Joe always liked it here. He always liked the fans. And people really, you know, liked him in return. I think that was really a two-way street.
Writer Chris Vitiello and NNO sports reporter Luke DeCock. Finally, we say goodbye to a musician who led a good long life. Wade Maynor died in September at the age of 104. With just 2 fingers, 5 strings, and a strong set of pipes, Wade Maynor forever changed the sound of old-time mountain music. Wade first experimented with the banjo as a kid in the western North Carolina mountains and eventually taught himself to play using only his thumb and index finger. Wade's innovative style of banjo finger-picking led to the birth of bluegrass music, and it inspired the careers of music pioneers like Bill Monroe and living legends like Doc Watson and Ralph Stanley, just to name a few. I spoke with Dick Spotswood, host of the Dick Spotswood Show on WAMU's Bluegrass Country. He's also the author of Banjo on the Mountain, Wade Maynor's First 100 Years. Sarah Bryan was with us in the studio. She's the editor of the Old Time Herald and the program manager at North Carolina's Folk Institute. And musician and historian David Holt joined us by phone. David was a longtime friend of Wade Maynor and host of Folkways, a program seen on UNC-TV. I asked David Holt to describe Wade Maynor's contribution to roots music.
Wade kind of kept the banjo before the public at a time when it was kind of fading out in the mid-30s, and sort of brought this really innovative two-finger style that really cut through on the records so people could really hear that banjo. And it was the forerunner of what became the three-finger style. And so not only his great banjo playing, but his great singing and great song selection and, you know, some very good songwriting. Wade was a very influential in the old time and the bluegrass scene. And, you know, I was just talking to Doc Watson the other day about this. Wade Maynor came to the blind school where Doc was when Doc was 10 years old. Mm. And Wade Maynor came and performed, and Doc said he never forgot that. And it really influenced him from then on.
Wow. I mean, Doc Watson at 10. Sarah Wade is credited with bridging the gap between that old-time music that David was talking about, bluegrass. We're going to hear a lot of that. So for the untrained ear, would you explain for us the difference between those two, if there is one?
Between old-time and bluegrass music?
Bluegrass, yeah.
Well, there are actually a lot of differences and, I'd say, even more similarities. They're both styles that are rooted in traditional Southern string music. I say much of bluegrass draws from old-time string band music, and they share a lot of tunes and songs, but that they would be played very differently. I mean, you'd recognize the difference in style. And I would say that bluegrass sort of springs from a performance and broadcast context originally, whereas old-time music came to that performance in broadcast mm-hmm. context in time, but it had sort of come from the community-based music, square dances and playing in the parlor at home.
Maybe it's a kind of a style of play more than something inherent in the music itself. Dick Spotswood, Wade's early affinity for that old-time music shouldn't be surprising. He was born and raised near Weaverville, a city in the mountains of western North Carolina. Tell us how he came to play the banjo in the first place.
Well, he talks about having a brother-in-law, the fellow that married his older sister, Essie, and he was a fiddle player, and they played for some of the local dances and community events that Sarah was just describing. And Roy owned, I'm blanking on his last name, Roy Banks, I'm sorry, owned a banjo, and that banjo was the one that Wade sort of picked up and learned on at these dances. Wade insists that he taught himself. He never had any instruction or anything, and given the individual sound that he developed on the five-string banjo, I'm very much inclined to believe him. When I was down last fall at University of North Carolina, a distant relative of Wade, a great-great-nephew or something along those lines, actually has that banjo that Wade learned on and brought it to the book signing event that we did at University of North Carolina. It was quite a moment.
And what distinguishes these styles? Clawhammer, two-finger, three-finger, what's the difference, and what is the difference in terms of the sound and the kind of music you're going to create?
I would defer to David on that, I think.
David?
I should run, get a banjo, and show you, but I'm not sure it would come across on the phone. But old-time clawhammer style is more of a loping style, duk duk a duk duk a duk bum diddy type sound like that. It's the original style that came from Africa that came with a banjo-like instrument several hundred years ago. And the mountain people, white mountain people, black mountain people, all played that style. Then somewhere along the line, after the Civil War period, a picking style developed where people would use their fingers, and much of it was played sort of in a classical, what they call classical banjo style, and that influenced the mountain people too. So I don't think Wade really invented this in a vacuum, because I know people considerably older than Wade, I did know them, I mean they're long gone, but they were playing in a style similar to Wade's, but Wade just had a very distinctive role that he did with just two fingers. So it's not syncopated the way Earl Scruggs' three-finger bluegrass banjo sounds, and that's sort of the difference. The driving three-finger sound with that syncopated that's the sound that most people hear on the banjo today, but Wade had something in between those two, in between the clawhammer, which was a loping style, and the syncopated bluegrass style.
And he talked with you about that back in at the tender age of 98 when you when you interviewed him. Let's hear what he has to say about how he picked up that style.
Okay.
Now, I was interested in like the sound of the banjo, and so while they would play for a square dance, you know, sometimes it would go 45 minutes to an hour, and then they'd take a break for about 15, 20 minutes, and they'd lay the banjo down, and I was kind of interested in it as a young boy. I'd go over and pick it up, trail on it a little bit. I kept monkeying with it, and I started a little bit of clawhammer stuff. And it wasn't very long then till I done this on my banjo. Here's why.
Just pick the strings with your fingers.
I just picked the string. Huh. And that something hit me in my ear there when it sounded like that. I said, well, now that sounded a little better than, you know, that. I said, and that gave me a sound there that was different from clawhammer. So I kept fooling with it, like I started with a two-finger banjo.
And nobody showed you how to
do that?
No. You just figured that out yourself?
Yeah.
Wade Maynard, born in Buncombe County in 1907. He died in February at the age of 104. We've celebrated eight great people this hour who moved on this year and left behind legacies that continue to enrich all of us who live in the state of North Carolina. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.